Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook.
Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business or nonprofit, go to our website at TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com for details. Man, we have another great show in store for you today. So sound the alarm. Get on Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare, or Tumblr. Send out emails and text messages. Call your friends and family and tell them to tune in right now to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And for those of you that are listening via Blog Talk Radio, leave your comments. Click the follow button or follow me on Twitter. And that's at TaylorMade101. I'll be reading your tweets live on the air. And I also have a chat room open. Out there in the chat room, you can leave your comments or ask questions. So whatever your pleasure, chat room, Twitter, Facebook, or just plain old my bell, we want to hear from you. But first, let's take a look at the current events.
Greetings and salutations, everyone. It is good to be back with you once again. We have another great show in store for you today. Let's take a look at what's on tap. Today we're going to talk a little bit about e-cigarettes. Are they good or bad for you? We're also going to look at UConn players starving. When is enough enough? We've been talking about this for several years now with respect to March Madness and May Sadness, as Reverend Jesse Jackson calls it. And I also want to look at military in the news again. Fort Hood, we didn't get a chance to talk about that last time. And also, there's this new controversy around African-American women and their hair in the military. So we're going to talk about that. Also, we have at the top of that next hour a segment that we do called Black Acre. Of course, a friend of the show, Leo Baron Hicks, has started this blog, and it's something that we want to talk about here on Current Events with Patrick Cook. But so if you to join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. But before we get started, I'd like to take a moment to look at President Barack Obama's comments that was made at the National Action Network about the GOP attempt at threatening voting rights in America more than at any point since the passage of the historic 1965 law expanding rights at the ballot box. I want to do that, and I want to start by listening to part of what he had to say. Take a listen. Okay, we'll have that video coming up real shortly. But in essence, President Obama kind of took a dig at the GOP regarding what they have been doing over the last several years in states like Ohio, and talking about them and their efforts to actually at least cut out souls to the polls, shorten times it takes to actually go out to vote, and other what President Obama seemed, and not necessarily just for President Obama, but seemed to think that are a direct attack on people and their rights to vote. And so he was actually at the National Action Network over the weekend, and I want to take a listen at what he had to say with regard to his idea of what's going on in the GOP. And after we play the video, it's coming up here shortly, but after we play the video, we really want you to weigh in on this, particularly around the tactics that the GOP are conducting and what you think people should be doing when it comes to voting nowadays. You know, we talked last week about the Supreme Court decision to allow more money into politics, and now it seems like this is a part of a bigger game plan. So let's take a listen. I think the producers have their videos ready now, so take a listen.
Just as inequality feeds on injustice, opportunity requires justice, and justice requires the right to vote. Every American citizen must have an equal right to vote. Voting is a time when we all have an equal say. Black or white, rich or poor, man or woman. Doesn't matter. Let's be clear. The real voter fraud is people who try to deny our rights by making bogus arguments about voter fraud.
That was President Obama moments ago speaking at the National Action Network convention in New York City. The president's speech, a fiery address that had quite a bit of campaign energy behind it, focused on the issue of voting rights and voter fraud, or lack thereof. Joining me now is host of MSNBC's The Reid Report, Joy Reid, and editor-at-large of Salon, Joan Walsh. My friends, thank you for joining me. I feel like Joan, you know, fired up and ready to go. The president is back. The Washington Post has a headline today saying that voting rights is the Democrats' most important project in 2014, and listening to the president today, that certainly seemed apparent.
You know, it seemed apparent. That was a really wonderful speech in a lot of ways, because he did something that's very tough, Alex. He did two things. He said to the audience and to those of us listening out here that the Republicans are trying to take people away people's rights. The real voting fraud is the people's people claiming voting fraud. He talked about the obstacles that are being put in people's way, but he also said we cannot let that stop us. And these messages don't always go together, right? We can sit and complain about Republicans, but then to come right back and say we're going to fight those laws. Eric Holder is out fighting those new laws. We're going to protect your rights. But in the meantime, you help us protect your rights. Don't fall into cynicism. So I thought it was a very effective speech. And yes, it was an opening salvo in the 2014 midterms, because we are going to see the anniversary of Freedom Summer. We are going to have an opportunity to rally Democrats and say, don't let people have died in vain.
So obviously, not only did I conclude that there are some issues with respect to Voting Rights Act. But also, it sounds like the president, the administration, and some news pundits also think that this is the case too. So I wanted to get you to weigh in on this. What is your opinion about the Voting Rights Act? And to join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. And joining me in the studio is the executive producer to talk about this, of current events, and the chief operating officer of Cook Enterprises. You can follow her on Twitter, and that's at Ash Jima, and also the author of a new book called Reflections, What I Know to Be True. I introduce the some and present the others, no other than Jima Hill Cook. Jima, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, as I played in the introduction there, I wanted to kind of get you to weigh in on what you believe that the American people should be doing with respect to the tactics being levied on them by the GOP, namely cutting out souls to the polls in some states, namely reducing the amount of times that people will be allowed to vote, and namely, you look at a Supreme Court decision to throw more money into politics, which means money doesn't translate into votes, but it does translate into ads, campaign ads, things of that nature. So what are your thoughts about these issues?
Well, I think, you know, we go back to when the Supreme Court did what it did in 2012. And so in terms of gutting out some of the main provisions of the Voting Rights Act. So what we can't do is be surprised and are alarmed that these things are happening statewide. You had several states, Texas included, that the day the Supreme Court did what it did, the Attorney General here went into full speed ahead, full motion to enact some really tough laws here in the state of Texas, and that has been going on all across the country. So what I don't want us to do is to get caught up in the outrage of it all and don't prepare for what could potentially be the outcome. So what the president is saying and what, you know, news media has, some have been talking about, is that we are in a difficult place because we shouldn't be making voting harder, as we've talked about on this show before, harder for people to do, but not necessarily you make it easy, but you should make it difficult. And if the rules we've had in place for all of these years and they have elected all of these previous presidents, what now has changed that we have to change the rules? Why now do we not want to value voting on Sunday or having longer early voting days or weekend early voting days? What's changed? And after you get out of the emotional sense of what has changed, then you have to figure out how are you going to adapt to what the changes are. And so, as I stated, as outraged as we are about the changes, we still need to prepare, because in the event that whatever happened in your state is upheld by whatever high court that is reviewing it, then you're going to have to be ready to be able to make sure that you get to participate in the voting. And I think I also mentioned, you know, okay, so we've got to make the adjustments. It's halftime. And at halftime, in any game, you make adjustments if you're down. If you're down 10 or, you know, you're football, you're down a touchdown, and you're getting the ball coming out the gate, you're going to make adjustments to what you're going to do coming back from halftime. Somebody is talking about who needs to guard somebody better, who needs to make sure that Kevin Durant isn't shooting threes all day long in your face, or LeBron is posting up and just drilling you in the paint. Somebody needs to make some adjustments. So as we go through this process, what adjustments do we need to make? And so if they want to say no Sunday souls to the polls, most churches are open several days throughout the week. Some have Tuesday night Bible study. Some have Wednesday night Bible study. Whatever that night is, then you make that be your souls to the polls, whatever day that is. And if you have to do more than one through the early voting period, or even the, you know, going into the generally, like, you know, the regular voting time, then make that happen. So we've got to make the adjustment until such a time that the law goes back to the way it was. And if it never goes back, that'll mean we don't go vote anymore. We just have to make the adjustments to it. And that's the mindset that we collectively have to have. So right now, some states are offering, you know, free IDs. They're not charging for them. And so how do we get those that don't have access, transportation, to get to the places to get the IDs? So we've got to start thinking about making the adjustments that are needed in order to still allow all of our votes to count, because we do know that each vote should count and everybody should have access to that. And we just have to make the adjustments to make it happen.
So what changed with the GOP and their assault on voting rights in the United States? And I'm talking about as recently as the Bush presidency, George W. Bush presidency. he signed an extension of the Voting Rights Act, and he championed the cause of Voting Rights Act. And we all know that President Bush was what some know to be a conservative. He was a big oil man. He did believe in – he was a war president. He was a person that kind of championed restricting legislation, you know, when it comes to businesses. So, you know, and he had some of the most prominent people supporting him in his efforts. I mean, he had Reverend Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, friends and relatives of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks, Dorothy Height, NAACP, and Julian Bond and former head Benjamin Hooks, all were a part of this ceremony that for him to sign the Voting Rights Act. He was, and in fact, President Bush even reached out to African Americans and in fact helped him get elected the second term. But now, in contrast, stark contrast to the GOP party today in 2014, and really since 2008, really, we've had an assault on the Voting Rights Act, and particularly around minorities, people of color, or should I say specifically African-American voters, because when you look at the percentage of people that are affected by this, you normally get a high number of black people that are affected by this. So going back to my question, what changed in the fact that in the GOP party, where they now when they used to champion Voting Rights Act, and now they began to try to restrict people's rights?
Well, I think the short answer of that is you look back at when they made some of their initial changes, because even looking at what happened in 2010 with the election of this current Congress and some of those in the House, which is when quote unquote the Democrats lost the House, and those same voting rights were in place at that time. Historically, Democrats do not show out in mass numbers in off-year elections and midterms as they do when they're the presidential candidate. So to ensure that will not be, that will not affect their numbers come this year, they started then messing with and redistricting in states, trying to suppress the vote of people of color. Why they did that, I really think it all goes down, because as we stated earlier and was always stated, we've used the same rules, the sense of democracy in terms of one man, one vote, what you could use as a form of ID, since I've been voting. So the only thing that changed was the person that sits at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. That's the only thing that's changed, the color of the person that's there. He's still a man, but he's not a white man. And, outside of that, because the lie they told around voter fraud has been debunked so many times, it's been, just completely blown out of the water. So they have no real reason for why they're doing it. And you look at the states and how they've redistricted and how they've made districts more, quote-unquote, conservative and Republican. It doesn't make sense why they would do it. I can only say, for what I can gather, is because of who now sits there and how he got there, which was with an outpouring support of people of color, of even elderly people voted
I just can't buy the fact that it's just an African American in the White House. I just can't buy the fact that that people are discontent with a black man in the White House. I mean, not to mention, when you have so many African Americans in prominent positions across the United States, not exclusively or entirely, but there are people in positions that are doing well. So it's not news to see blacks ascend to any high office. So, but I would like to offer an alternative, which is, I mean, when you look at the Browning of the United States, I think that the numbers are just different nowadays. I mean, when you look at the percentages as a whole, you're going to have more in the minority population than you're going to have in the majority. There used to be the majority population. And so the views of Americans are now more spread out. The views are more progressive as opposed to conservative. And so it seems to me that when you have a restriction on in one area, people try to loosen up another area. And see, and what I'm talking about is you having a restriction in the amount of people that agree with you and your views, then you have to loosen up another part, which is the money. And so the money is pretty much equal to influence. Doesn't make a decision, but it has an enormous influence on people's decisions. So I would offer that the singular event of having a black man in the White House, I don't think is enough to cause people to act in this manner, because this manner is more destructive over a longer period of time, right? We're talking the maximum time that any person can be in the White House is 8 years. And so, but the lasting effect of these changes can be for generations. So I just want to kind of push on this issue of just being a black person. So why do you think it's just that?
I'm not saying it's just that. I'm saying that I think that has a lot to do with it. So it's not just that, for sure. When you're dealing with these sort of issues, it's never just one thing. But you do have to figure out what was the impetus, what was the driving thing, what was the tipping point. And if the tipping point was all of a sudden the laws are different than what they were when he was elected, and 2 years into his term, things change when power in one house of Congress changes. And then all of these other things start happening. Once you start looking backwards, what is the common denominator? And it's a combination of several things. It's not a thing, but it is a combination of several things. But I'm not going to pretend as if that elephant is not in the room, and not say that him being there was somewhat of a tipping point for some people to be like, oh, we've got to do something different. Because let's think about this. Their goal was to have an impact on the 2012 election. So in the 2012 election would have meant he would not have gotten reelected, because they would have made it more difficult for that very population, people of color, elderly, young people, to vote. And so if they had been successful in 2012, he may not be serving a second term. But because they were not, and because people woke up and saw what was happening, that, they were really feeling as though you're trying to take something away from me. And so they didn't mind the standing in the line for 7 hours. They didn't mind having, to go through an extra step to cast that vote, because it was important to them. The issue now is, would they have that same zeal and same fire in their belly and same desire right now in the midterms, when it's not about President Obama? It's not about his second term. It's about what's happening in your state, which is what, it should be about 80% of the time anyway, about what's happening locally. So by no means am I saying that's the only reason, but I do believe that it's part of it, because it hadn't happened before. I mean, in your intro, you talked about what George, President Bush had done prior to. So what changed? And so the only thing that changed was the color, and not even the gender, but the color of the person that was now in the White House. That's the only thing that changed. And the Browning of America, as you termed it. And so those two things could be what, may have caused some feathers to ruffle and be like, wait a minute, we need to make sure these people are legal. I mean, think about all of the chaos about whether or not he could even be president. Talking about his birth certificate and all of these things that you've never heard before for a president. That's never happened.
Yeah, but it goes back. It goes back to my position on a confusion or influence. The term I used was influence. The reason why they make these statements because they want to cause chaos. They want to influence you in a certain direction. Because if you question in your mind whether or not this man can be president, or whether he has the ability to win, or whether he's legal, then it questions whether or not he is the right person for the job, and it questions you whether or not you should vote for that person. So it's a direct inference from one to the other, which means that either you stay home or you vote for somebody else. When I talk about this browning of America, that was a great article entitled "The Political Future of a Browning America," and it's entitled. It's by Mark Funkhauser. It was written last year, and it says America's most basic law, the Constitution, is exclusively the product of white men. Since this country's founding, white men have been deciding public policy with effort to understand how people of color see the world. Yet, for nearly our entire history, the racial landscape of America has encompassed a white majority and a black minority. That era is over. Calling the phenomenon the browning of America, demographer James Johnson of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill notes that only 7% of the net growth in the country's population from 2000 to 2010 was non-Hispanic white. More than half of the country's net growth was Hispanic. Since then, however, Asians has overtaken Hispanics as the largest group of immigrants to the United States. So it, regardless of how you move, shape, bend, twist the numbers, the fact still remains that we have in this browning of non-Hispanic white men, or we have in this browning of Americans that are just non-white. And when you look at that, and you look at the projections of 2017, 2020, 2050, then a majority of all Americans could be people of color. Now, this is a Pew Research Center projects that by 2050, a majority of all Americans could be people of color. Now, well, if you contrast that with another report that was talked about the wealth in America, the wealth is still not being distributed just like the color has been distributed. And so when you say, I don't have the numbers to make the votes, because it's just clearly not there in the numbers, right? Then what tactics can you employ or deploy to change people's mind or to cause confusion or to cause chaos that are not, allow them to either stay home because I don't know the new law, can I go vote on Monday, can I vote on Tuesday, or you say vote for somebody else? And I think this position that I hold is going to be consistent over the next two decades as we see more and more of the brown of America and more of these politicians not being able to hold office because, you know, in politics, there's a lot of money and a lot of power.
Yeah, I agree with that. There is a lot of money and a lot of power. That's why they get there and don't want to leave. You can go, you got some that's been there long as we've been alive, so. And, you know, at some point, they should probably try to do something else and let somebody else get to Washington. But because of that power, influence, and money, nobody wants to give that up. And eventually you stop even doing the work that you originally said you wanted to do because now all you want is the power and the money.
Yeah, we're going to take a quick break. When we return, I want to shift the conversation to power and money, but specifically around these things called electronic cigarettes. I want to get your opinion on this. So join the conversation. The number to call 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook.
You are listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. My mom and dad will be right back after these messages.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our company's tailor-made training and consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jema. And Ask Jema says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy, and I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend, and of course, my East Boone friend.
Need a new website? Haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. I want to take a moment to talk about electronic cigarettes. They are receiving a lot of notoriety over the last several months, primarily because people, A, don't understand what they are and what they do to your body, and B, why in the world would you want to go from one type of smoke to another? And so people are saying, on the one hand, it helps them kind of remove the sensation of smoking. On the other hand, people say it's harmful. So there's this big debate going on right now about these electronic cigarettes. And I want to hear from you. What do you think about them? Do you think they're good, bad, or, you know, what's your position? And I ask that because more and more people are starting to smoke these things in public. And so my position is, if you tell me that secondhand smoke is bad for me, then it doesn't matter whether smoke comes from an electronic cigarette or a nicotine or a traditional cigarette. If smoke is bad for me, secondhand smoke that is, then smoke is bad for me. It doesn't matter where it comes from. So I want to see what you think about this. And so first of all, let me back up just a little to talk about what the electronic cigarette is, right? So, courtesy of Wikipedia, it says, an electronic cigarette is a personal vaporizer, is also called, or electronic nicotine delivery system, and not to be confused with smokeless cigarette, is a battery-powered device which simulates tobacco smoking. It was first patented in 1963. By Herbert A. Gilbert. It generally uses a heating element known as an atomizer that vaporizes a liquid solution. Some solutions contain a mixture of nicotine and flavorings, while others release a flavored vapor without nicotine. First generation of electronic cigarettes are usually designed to simulate smoking implements, such as cigarettes or cigars, in their use and or appearance, since they are not as powerful as new generation personal vaporizers. First generation e-cigarettes doesn't offer the same level of efficacy when delivering nicotine to the end user. They also produce less vapor than their counterparts. So, Jim, let me get you to weigh in here. What do you think about this whole notion of these electronic cigarettes? Are they good or bad?
Okay. Now, I'm a non-smoker. So let me put my disclaimer out there right now. So are they good or bad? I'm going to say they're bad. And I'm going to say they're bad because we should know by data of the results of what happens when we do anything artificial. Anything artificial over time is not good for us. And we can just take a simple look at our food industry, right? And the art now, what we thought was good in terms of these artificial sweeteners and this and that, we're finding that they're not, over time in the body, they don't process well, they don't do right, and you have more problems. So you just might as well go and have the regular sugar because the processed artificial stuff is not working. I'm going to say the same thing with this cigarette stuff because it is, I don't think it's regulated properly, for one. I think I read a report that we've gone from one call a month from the CDC saying they had one call a month back in 2010 of poisoning to 215 a month in the month of February of this year. So that's a problem in terms of poisoning, and that it's been with children, young children under five, the highest percentage, some kind of where they're getting a hold of these things. And then the next percentage is of 20 and older, 42% of poison. They're calling in poison issues. So something about it isn't right. And so if you go, you know, if you're going to smoke, just go on and get your cigarette. I mean, you just might, because this isn't helping in the long run. And I see people all over the place. I mean, at the park. And I'm like, if you can't smoke, you shouldn't be able to have an electronic cigarette at the park either.
Right. That's my point. So the position of having,
I mean,
because it's electronic, doesn't hinder. It's smoking. Doesn't matter what you're smoking. If smoking is banned, and smoking, regardless of what the,
right,
what the flavor
right.
of it, should be banned.
Right. So now we have to define smoking seriously.
Right. As a nicotine filtered tobacco related. You know, when you start doing all of that, then obviously we have a problem.
Yeah, I agree.
I want to talk a little bit about the notion. You mentioned very, very, very briefly about regulations. I want to talk a little bit about the World Health Organization has stated that the efficacy of electronic cigarette as an aid in smoking cessation has not been demonstrated. There was a 2011 review says that electronic cigarettes may aid in smoking cessation and are likely to be more effective than traditional pharmacotherapy. As the physical stimuli of holding and puffing of the electronic cigarette may be better at improving short-term craving. The review found no studies that directly measured the effectiveness of electronic cigarettes in smoking cessation and examined two published studies that indirectly considered the issue by measuring the effect of the product on cravings and other short-term indicators. Now, the American Association of Public Health Physicians suggests that those who are unwilling to quit tobacco smoking are unable to quit with medical advice and pharmaceutical methods should consider other nicotine-containing products such as electronic cigarettes and chewing tobacco. So Jim, when you look at these opposing views with respect to what they're going to the results of for smokers, then how can you not, as a smoker, want to give it a try if you're hooked on nicotine?
Well, of course you're going to want to give it. Of course you're going to want to give it a try because it's a new thing, and that's just how our mind works. We see something new, and we want to run out and try it and see what it does. But in running out and trying it to see what it does, you need to, you know, do some research about it, because just because they selling it don't mean you need to go and try it. Because if you got a problem with nicotine, this has nicotine in it. It's not. It's liquid nicotine. that isn't going to help you get off of nicotine. What's in an e-cigarette is liquid nicotine. So it's not stopping you. You're not getting it through a tobacco or whatever. However, you're still getting whatever it is, whatever the substance that is the addictive factor. If it's the nicotine, you're still getting that. You just don't have a cigarette. You're smoking it through some little tube-looking thing. So
yeah,
I don't know if it's going to help you do anything. It's going to help you stop smoking.
So let's take a listen to this Washington Post report. And it kind of breaks e-cigarettes down in the opposing views. And so let's take a listen, and let's have a quick, brief discussion about e-cigarettes. Take a listen.
E-cigs, short for electronic cigarettes, are quickly becoming the latest product to be kicked to the curb by anti-smoking activists. Before we get deeper into the debate, here are the basics. E-cigarettes are battery-operated devices that turn liquid or gel nicotine, flavoring, and other chemicals into a vapor when they're inhaled. They've become more and more popular over the past few years, and while the Food and Drug Administration is reviewing how e-cigs should be regulated, no decision has been made yet. But that isn't stopping states and several major cities from passing rules in the federal government's absence.
City leaders voted to ban e-cigarettes in public places in Los Angeles.
The ban takes effect in 4 months, and businesses will have another 6 to get their signs in place.
When it comes to the health and welfare of the city of Chicago, not just children, but also adults, I'm not waiting for the FDA to lead from behind.
E-cigarette advocates are pushing back.
The public use of e-cigarettes actually promotes what appears to be a beneficial alternative. If you were to argue that something that may look like a cigarette promotes cigarettes in public, you could make that argument about a variety of products. Somebody could say that drinking water could look like drinking vodka, but you're not going to ban drinking water in public.
Now that it's switched to blue, I feel better about myself, and I feel free to have one almost anywhere.
Experts from both sides of the debate say e-cigs aren't nearly as harmful as the real thing because they don't have the same chemicals that burning tobacco does. But public health advocates worry that the true health impacts are still unknown.
There are several considerations here. One is we do think that kids watching people smoke in public and public places becomes a sort of role model to glamorize the smoking behavior, which could lead them to smoke the much more dangerous combusted cigarette. Also for adults, if we allow this, it becomes a bridge product that makes it easy for them to get from their dangerous cigarette in the morning to their dangerous cigarette in the evening.
Okay, so as you can see, there's definitely people on both sides of the issue with respect to smoking these things. I guess my biggest concern is primarily associated with the health risks, right? So the Federal Drug Administration is really our governing body to say what you can and cannot do. Now, I would argue that they have been negligent or have fallen short of their job with our food. So I'm not going to put a lot of stock in whether or not the FDA has done a job or has not done a job when it comes to any product, because when you look at the fact that our food is essentially killing us today, then they're asleep at the wheel. But I will argue that the FDA does have some responsibility of protecting the American people. Of course, we all have our choices to make, but they do bear some of the responsibility, at least telling us what the implications are, especially with respect to our health. So I guess my question to you, Jima, is the FDA, why do you think the FDA has not moved in the right, in any direction on this issue?
Well, it goes back to, I believe, what you were alluding to earlier about influence and power and money and who's in charge, you know, who's really in charge of these governing bodies. Are they the lobbyists that tend to have all the commercials and they have the ability to glamorize items that we later find may not be to our best benefit? Or are they, you know, hearing the voices of the ones crying in the wilderness stating this is just another way to get young people to be smoking? And so We are easily influenced. It's unfortunate, but as a group, as a race, as a human race, I'm speaking, we're easily influenced by what we see. So if we're wanting to slow down the number of people smoking, providing them a cigarette that, although is not in tobacco form, but still carries the addictive agent of nicotine in it, I don't know how that's helping. So I think the FDA is slow to move because it doesn't, I'm giving it the benefit of the doubt when it feels like having some sort of knee-jerk reaction to this. But right now, these e-vapor cigarette places are popping up everywhere, and there's no real regulation on them. I mean, you have some in the state by state in terms of whether or not they say who you can sell to or whether or not it's the same as a cigarette, you have to be 18 or older. And so you have, and then they come in these different flavors, and they have, and so they look more, you know, appealing than what they should because it is still, nicotine is a drug. So it's why the FDA hasn't moved fast on this, I don't know, because I think we're going to find out that this isn't going to be good for the body. I'm pretty sure at some point the study will show that it's not, it is more harmful than regular cigarette smoke. I guarantee you that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, so what's interesting is that, you know, when I look at my PhD work, we always look at how something performs relative to the existing body of work. So you really look within those constraints. And so if you take that position on e-cigarettes, well, we have a body of work to really look at, not from what we know as American people based on the last few years that we've seen them popping up, but really since we can really start our research from looking into these things and from 1963 when it was first patented. And you look at the research that went into the electronic form, and then you look at all of the issues associated with the electronic cigarette, then we have something to at least to start our exploratory work. And when you look at also what the USDA or FDA has done with respect to their research in 2009 regarding safety, they have taken a position on it. It has not been anything that's real concrete, but they have taken a position. And in fact, a preliminary analysis of e-cigarettes cartridges by the FDA in 2009 identified that some contained tobacco-specific nitrosamines, what they call TSNAs, known cancer-causing agents. The amount of TSNAs present were on par with existing NRT products like nicotine, gum, and inhalers, because you know you have all of these different variety of things that people try to do with respect to getting people off nicotine. And you may be familiar with the gum and patches and everything like that. But the FDA's analysis also detected that a poisonous and hygroscopic liquid in a single cartridge manufactured by Smoking Everywhere and Nicotine in One cartridge claimed to be nicotine-free. So although some of them may claim to have nicotine in them, may not have nicotine in them, they may have some other type of agents in there. Because they want to, you know, when people talk about artistic freedom when they make a movie and they want to kind of distort history a little bit, as in was what people had said about Noah, the movie that was recently released, he took some artistic freedom. There's also artistic freedom, if you will, when you're kind of making these products, right? They know nicotine causes these particular issues, and it may not have this flavor in it. More recently, we know with what you mentioned about artificial sweeteners, right? We know what sugar does, and so if people have this heartburn about sugar, then they try to replace it with these sugar substitutes, right? And we know they cause harm because they take artistic freedom, if you will, to alter what's in them so that it can appeal to a person's palate, right? So similarly, when we look at this e-cigarette and the fact that they're replacing nicotine with something else in some instances could be causing harm. And as you mentioned, this poison has been and its increase of poison, you know, it concerns me. And as a concerned citizen, I'm more concerned not because I intend to go out and purchase an e-cigarette to smoke it, but I'm concerned because of the secondhand smoke issue, as I mentioned earlier. If you tell me that secondhand smoke is bad with nicotine, so what makes secondhand smoke good then with e-cigarettes? Because I would conclude that if secondhand smoke is bad, it is always bad. So therefore, we should not be exposed to secondhand smoke with nicotine or secondhand smoke with e-cigarettes. What do you think about that?
I agree. And I think the FDA needs to hurry up and come up with whatever it's going to do. It's been given the green light by Congress to come up with some regulations, and they need to act quickly because, as you stated and I stated, children now are being impacted by this. There's no, you know, regulation, I don't believe, on how old you can be, so they have it in different flavors. So, you know, I'm thinking green apple is the bomb, so I'm going to go smoke me some green apple. Give me a green apple flavored e-cigarette juice. I mean, because it's liquid. And so I'm doing that, and we know nicotine has an impact on the growth of the brain and the functionality of it. And so if I'm in middle school and high school and I'm smoking these e-cigarettes because of the flavoring and the packaging of it, I'm still getting nicotine into my system, which is having an impact on the development of my brain. Somebody needs to regulate that. Somebody needs to say, no, children still cannot smoke e-cigarettes. You know, just as though they, you know, are not allowed to go and purchase and buy regular cigarettes and tobacco cigarettes, they shouldn't be able to buy this either. And I mean, we know that we can't stop it all, but I'm like you. I'm just as concerned about that. And, you know, what is in the chemical? And they don't know. That's the problem. They don't know what's in there. So you're right. Secondhand from that could be just as dangerous as secondhand from tobacco. But we don't know.
Because we don't know.
Or more. But we don't know because we don't even know what's in the chemical. Which is devastating that somebody is out there putting something in their body that they don't even know what it is.
So what's also is just as interesting to me, though, is that, you know, what do you do? You know, we're talking about e-cigarettes now, but what if we talked about e-steak or e-water or apples, you know, and people begin to make these derivative of these products, and they're not being regulated, right? And now my son is no longer 7, he's 12, he has a dollar, and he goes out and buys an e-apple, and there's no regulation against it. Who do I sue? How do I prevent this as an American citizen that's people that are producing non-regulated products that are selling this to the public, putting them on the shelves, having people exposed to this without any safety concerns? Now, I know I have the responsibility of saying, hey, son, don't do that, and they have to go out and make their decision whether or not they do that. But just the mere exposure of that and the mere probability of that happening, it could happen. And so, as a citizen, what do I do? I mean, what are our options as an American citizen that says, no, I don't want you on my block, I don't want you selling these things, because I don't know what they are? I mean, what do you think about that?
I think that's a valid point, and I think, unfortunately, because of where we are and the timing of it, and with the FDA has not done anything as it relates the regulations of it, we're in a bad situation. That could go one way or another fairly quickly. Will it take somebody dying from poison, from a poisoning for somebody to begin to put some regulations on it? And will parents think about locking that up like they, quote unquote, lock up their guns so that, you know, they're not in the hands of children? Will schools ban electronic cigarettes from, you know, I mean, there's supposed to be no smoking on campuses. Will e-cigarettes become a part of that? I mean, what will businesses do? And in the interim, in the event that something happens, something traumatic, something devastating, something life-threatening happens to an individual from smoking these e-cigarettes, you're right. What is their recourse? Who are they suing? The makers of the e-cigarette? Are they suing the government for lack of regulation? Exactly where do they go with their complaints? And why do we always have to be in reactionary mode? Why can't laws and policies and procedures and regulations be put in place on the front end of something? Why we have to wait until there's something tragic that happens, and then all of a sudden we want to regulate everything. So hopefully, you know, the time is sooner rather than later as to when the FDA will get on board and begin to look at this thing.
Yeah, I suspect that in the months and years to come, we start to see an increase in the amount of ailments associated with these e-cigarettes, because when you patent some in 1963 and it doesn't rear its ugly head until after, you know, you've banned smoking and they just move it into another form, I suspect that people will start, you know, going to the hospital in higher rates. I suspect that, you know, the byproduct of the waste that's created from these products will cause problems as well. I mean, and so I'm sure this won't be the last time that we cover e-cigarettes in this fashion.
Right, and they're not really, I mean, an article I was reading stated that most people that smoke e-cigarettes, they still smoke regular cigarettes. They just smoke those out in public because they're more acceptable. And so they'll smoke those at work or, at, you know, in front of a restaurant or whatever, and still go home and have their regular tobacco cigarette. So, I mean, it's not as though, I mean, now they, you know, they're getting just as much, if not more, nicotine in their system because of the use of those of the vapors of the electronic cigarettes. So it's going to be interesting. I agree with you. This story will grow. It will continue to develop.
Yes, indeed. All right, it's time for another break. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Shima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy, and I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend, and of course, my East Point.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Current Events with Patrick Cook.
Patrick Cook.
In Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. There are reports that at least 3 people are dead following shootings at 2 separate Jewish facilities in Kansas City, Missouri. Authorities say a suspect was taken into custody at a nearby elementary school this afternoon. The first shooting took place at the Jewish Community Center of Greater Kansas City, the second at the Village Shalom Assisted Living Facility. Ukraine's army is preparing for a major military operation in the eastern part of the country. Pro-Russian militias have taken over several government buildings in recent days. NPR's Ari Shapiro is in Donetsk, Ukraine.
The president of Ukraine delivered a statement where he said that these armed demonstrators who've taken over government buildings in various cities throughout the east have until Monday morning local time to lay down their weapons without prosecution. Otherwise, he says the military is preparing for a large-scale assault. He says he will not allow what happened in Crimea to happen in eastern Ukraine. Of course, what happened in Crimea is that Russia annexed that peninsula, and he blames Moscow of orchestrating the protests here in the east as well.
NPR's Ari Shapiro reporting. Egypt's prosecutor general is ordering 220 defendants to be put on trial in connection with protests earlier this year. From Cairo, Merritt Kennedy reports it's the latest in a series of mass trials.
Police arrested the defendants on January 25th, the anniversary of Egypt's 2011 uprising. On that day, the Muslim Brotherhood called for protests and clashes ensued with police. The arrested demonstrators are charged with attempted murder and assaulting security forces. Egypt's prisons are packed with people arrested from demonstrations, and the courts are working overtime amidst an ongoing crackdown on dissent. Last month, at another mass trial, a judge sentenced 529 people to death after only two court sessions. Amnesty International called the ruling a grotesque example of the selective nature of Egypt's justice system, and defense lawyers have filed an appeal. For NPR News, I'm Merritt Kennedy in Cairo.
Federal investigators in Northern California say despite witness reports, they can't confirm the FedEx truck that collided with a student tour bus on Thursday was on fire. National Transportation Safety Board member Mark Rosekind says there's nothing to support the claim.
Our fire group has examined the accident scene and vehicles. There is no evidence of pre-impact fire located at the accident scene, on the median, or on the highway.
The NTSB says the investigation could last more than a year. It's also looking at whether fire safety measures could have allowed more of the 48 bus occupants to escape unharmed. 10 people died in the crash, including 5 students, 3 adult chaperones, and both drivers. This is NPR News in Washington. A United Nations panel on climate change is warning that faster action is needed. Otherwise, the world may have to rely on expensive technologies to combat climate change. Leading scientists meeting in Berlin have released a 33-page summary meant to guide the nations working to cut a climate deal by the end of 2015. In St. Peter's Square, tens of thousands of people gathered this morning for Palm Sunday, and Pope Francis again surprised the Catholic world. NPR Sylvia Poggioli reports he ignored his prepared text and delivered an off-the-cuff Palm Sunday message.
Francis called on people, himself included, to look into their hearts to see how they're living their lives. That is the question that accompanies us through Holy Week, he said. He spoke for 15 minutes and used a wooden pastoral staff carved by Italian prison inmates, a sign of his determination to focus the church's attention on people at the margins of society. After the ceremony, the Pope hopped onto his Popemobile and moved through the crowd, often getting off to pose for selfies with young people. Palm Sunday opens Holy Week that culminates with Easter Mass next Sunday. Many faithful will remain in Rome for the April 27th canonization ceremony of two popes, John Paul II and John the 23rd. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
NASA says it's planning to go ahead with tomorrow's planned launch of a supply ship to the International Space Station. The launch comes despite a critical computer outage at the space outpost. The SpaceX capsule will deliver more than 2 tons of cargo. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from eSure.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. It's the top of the hour, and I want to shift now to a segment we call Black Acre. It's a policy form incorporated or LLC by Leo Baron Hicks, who's a friend of the show. And he has this absolutely wonderful blog that he does. And it really is something that I think that is more action-oriented more than anything. So it really stimulates thinking, thought. It really gets you out there to move. So I would encourage you to go out there and take a look at that. And you can get there to Black Acre Policy Forum. That's BlackAcre, BlackAcrePolicyForum.org. It's all one word, BlackAcrePolicyForum.org. And you'll get a chance to see all of the great blog posts that he has out there. And so I want to talk about one he posted recently, and it's entitled, Where Do We Go From Here? So I'm going to read the segments of the blog, and I'm going to take you down to a few of the questions. And I want to kind of to get you to weigh in, to the listening audience to weigh in on these questions, because I think, again, it really stimulates thought, and more importantly, it really stimulates the listening audience out there to take some action, not just to be a person that's want to talk about issues, but to actually do something about them. And so that's why I'm really excited about having this segment on the show. So, and it reads, on August 28, 1963, Martin Luther King and other icons of the Civil Rights Movement led the Civil Rights March on Washington. Officially known as the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, the event was attended by approximately 250,000 people. Not only was it the largest demonstration ever held in the nation's capital, it was the first to have extensive television coverage. The march was not the creation of one individual. It was instead a coalition of several civil rights organizations, all of which generally had different approaches and different agendas. The Big Six organizers were James Farmer of the Congress of Racial Equality Corps, Martin Luther King of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC, John Lewis of the Student Nonviolent Coordination Committee, SNCC, and A. Philip Randolph of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, Roy Wilkins of the National Association of Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, and Whitney Young Jr. of the National Urban League. The stated demands of the march were the passage of meaningful civil rights legislation, the elimination of racial segregation in public schools, protection for demonstrators against police brutality, a major public works program to provide jobs, the passage of a law prohibiting racial discrimination in public and private hiring, a $2 an hour minimum wage, a self-government for the District of Columbia, which had a black majority. On August 28, 2013, citizens from around the country gathered once again in the nation's capital to commemorate this historic event. February 26, 2012 was a day of destiny for another Martin. On this day, 17-year-old Trayvon Martin, a black male high school student in Sanford, Florida, was gunned down by one George Zimmerman, a 28-year-old mixed-race Hispanic neighborhood watch coordinator. Even though Mr. Zimmerman was a grown man armed with a loaded weapon, who followed and gunned down an unarmed youth who had done no wrong, George Zimmerman argued that he was the victim and that he acted in self-defense. On July 13, 2014, a jury of six agreed with George Zimmerman in acquitting him of second-degree murder and manslaughter. Interviews, marches, and protests were held shortly thereafter, all demanding justice for Trayvon. It would appear that this is the season of important anniversaries: Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, delivered in 1864, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, as well as the aforementioned March on Washington, just to name a few, were all momentous occasions. All involve questions of justice, race, and racial relations in America. All are significant windows into the heart of our nation, and all raise the question of whether African Americans have progressed beyond Martin Luther King, and what should we do, if anything, after the travesty of Trayvon Martin and the equally troubling case of Jordan Davis, another victim of racial and cultural hatred. As to the first question, the answer is regrettable. African Americans have not moved forward since Martin Luther King, We are not even keeping pace. We are instead marching backwards. No, make that flying backwards as quickly and decidedly as we can. To be sure, we have made some progress. The number of African Americans household earning $75,000 or more has grown by 63.9% in the last decade, a rate greater than that of the overall population. This continued growth in affluence, social influence, and household income will continue to impact the community's economic power, especially with women. The percentage of African Americans attending college or earning a degree has increased to 44% for men and 53% for women. Higher educational and professional success, along with a lower birth rate, is increasing both the age and affluence of the population, increasing the demand for aging, healthcare, and financial management services. According to the Huffington Post, Black Voices, September 18, 2013, by 2015, the buying power of African Americans will exceed $1.1 trillion. This figure equates to the buying power of the 16th largest company in the world. Collectively, this consumer spending exceeds the gross domestic production of Egypt, Turkey, Poland, Australia, Taiwan, and more than 150 other nations of the world. And some of us have achieved wealth and success beyond anyone's wildest imagination. However, it is not acceptable that a few have prospered while the vast majority remains financially and spiritually improvised. In addition, material possessions are not the only measure of people's success. Asset management, including asset acquisition, nurturing assets, wealth protection, retirement planning, wealth perpetuation, perpetuation for future generations, and empowering family members with stewardship and accountability are equally important. More material is the protection and nurturing of human, intellectual, and civic, social assets, the absence of which even the wealthiest groups perish. It is here where we have regressed. Greater than economics, ours is a spiritual impoverishment, a diminution of our basic human, intellectual, and civic, social assets, a material loss of our collective purpose, dignity, and decency. The evidence of this loss is unmistakable. The symptoms of this spiritual impoverishment are undeniable. The challenges we, therefore, face are considerable. And while racism remains a significant problem, our diaspora is much a matter of within as without, a question of culture as much as ethnicity, a condition of values more than money. It goes on to say, a good place to start is the very thing that helped us survive and prosper lo the many centuries of slavery, Jim Crow, and the ethnic cleansing of lynchings and white race riots, solid middle class culture. The tenets of this culture includes family, faith, work, education, civic responsibility, respect for women and one's elders, modest dress and neatness of appearance, hard work and home ownership. Needless to say, respectful and law-abiding behavior, staying out of trouble, and avoiding jail and or prison was a must. The controlling message constantly transmitted and consistently reinforced by this culture was to strive, to accomplish, to overcome, to excel, to achieve, and to succeed, regardless how difficult. The goal was to always be at our best, no matter what. Thus, if you had a special event to attend, you dressed up in your Sunday's best instead of dressing down in your everyday worst. If your clothes were dirty, you cleaned them. If there was a hole in your pants, you mended it. In short, the Black middle class culture inspired us to pursue personal and collective greatness. We owed it to each other. We owed it to the past, the present, and the future. Every day, we went to school to learn as much as we could. We did not disrupt class or disrespect the teacher for fear of the dreaded trip to the principal office, and even worse, the ordeal of one's parents afterwards. We opened the door for women and gave us up our seats to the elderly. If we did curse or smoke, we certainly didn't do it around adults. In their presence, it was strictly yes, ma'am, and no, sir. We felt shame and embarrassment whenever we caught doing wrong or would never, ever dream of referring to any black woman as a female dog, even if she was. Yes, income and education inequality was worsened, and never have our men been incarcerated to the degree that they are now. Is racism a factor? Of course it is, and we should do all that we can to combat it. But the greater problem lies in the hijacking of a culture that has served us well by a social ethos and that has not. A culture that instructs us to treat one another far worse than our antagonists and whose values and attendance are repugnant. More disturbing, we seem not to appreciate the seriousness of our plight. We appear to be unaware, indifferent, resigned, or apathetic to our predicament. Missing is the fierce urgency of now, the dogged, unwavering determination to address our situation. Absent is the clear ability or desire to be honest with ourselves, if no one else. It is well past that time that we look in the mirror, that we search our own souls. Ours is to prevail over any and all obstacles, not to fail because of them. How did we get to this point? Where are the constructive goals, conduct, and values so necessary to excel? Where did we go so wrong, and what can we and should we do to correct the situation? Now, Black Acre was not developed to establish the wisdom of a single person. It was instead to create it to prove how intelligent and insightful you are. So rather than answer these vital questions, Black Acre poses the following inquiries to you, the Black Acre family. Are we avoiding a painful yet essential truth about our plight? Is our dysfunction purely a matter of racism, or are we at least to some extent culpable for our own situation? And if we are complicit for our own problem, what should we do about it? So I pose that question, Jima. So let's first start with the basic premise of avoiding a painful yet essential truth about our plight. You know, when you look at all of the things that was laid down by Leo Baron Hicks and the plight and the great things we used to be and we have come to be, and then the trajectory that we're on now, you know, are we really blind to the fact that we are not on the right course?
No, I don't think we're blind to the fact that we're not on the right course. I think subconsciously we were lulled into a sense of comfort, and in that comfort we didn't feel as though there was much left to fight for, and so we were not prepared for battle. We allowed ourselves to fall asleep in the poppy field, as did Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. And so now that we are awakened, we're like, okay, well, what happened to the jobs, what happened to public school, what happened to my voting rights? So we're awakened now to all these ills, you know, in the community because we were lulled in some false sense of security. So, you know, that's pretty much, in my opinion, where we are right now. We're just now in pockets, not in its entirety, coming to grips with accepting that some decisions we made may have been good for the moment, but was not good for long term.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. We're going to go to the phone lines right now. We got a caller, 0606. Give us your name, where you're calling from.
This is your humble servant, Mr. Cook, Leo Baron Hicks calling.
Oh, awesome, awesome, awesome. We have the author of Black Acre on the line. Leo Baron Hicks, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot.
So first of all, let me say, another amazing, amazing article. The way you laid it out, I mean, talking about the good, the bad, and the ugly, to be quite frank. And so I want to pose the question to you. Are we avoiding a painful yet it sent the truth about our plight.
Yes, absolutely.
And if so, what should we do about it?
I think we should demand as much of ourselves as we do of everyone else. I note for the record that after Trayvon Martin was gunned down, there was a hue and cry about justice. There was a sense of moral outrage. There was a demand for accountability, as there should have been. Yet, since Trayvon Martin was killed, thousands have been killed in Chicago alone. Not St. Louis, not Memphis, not California, but just Chicago. And 99% of those African Americans who were killed in Chicago were killed by other African Americans. And I just don't see the same moral outrage and the same demand for justice when we mistreat each other as occurs when someone else mistreats us.
You know, that's an excellent point. Jim, why is it then that we could have rallies for the one and not have rallies for the 1,000?
Well, I don't think it's that we don't have rallies for the 1,000. I think in that rally, we really don't know what we're asking for. I think it's a matter of the people in the city of Chicago, where all of this is happening, for some reason, don't know what to do with it all. They don't know who to go to. You have some that's at the hand of people that look just like them, of other young black males. You have some that's at the hand of police. You have some that they don't know where. You just, you know, there's a body somewhere, and for whoever does know, they're not willing to come out and talk about it. So I agree that there should be more outrage. And I agree that it should be a more concerted effort and more direct about the access of guns in our community, the lack of respect of life in our community, because when you're taking your own life, which is what essentially is happening when it's, you know, which I don't really like black-on-black crime, but when you hear that and you see that and you see that the perpetrator is the same race and gender of the person in which they just killed, you know, something else is happening in that community. And what is that something else? What is making those in that community respond to whatever they're dealing with that way? And that's the layer that we've never addressed. I mean, we'll talk about gun buybacks and decrease in violence, but what is it that's going on that's making you feel that's the only way to handle whatever it is you're dealing with? So I agree, there has to be more outrage, but not just outrage. Out of the outrage should come some action. What is it? What are we going to do? What type of policing and or managing and or hitting the streets are we going to do in those communities where it's prevalent that somebody else is in charge? Because it's obviously not the police. Because they, you know, if they were in charge and able to handle it, it should be handled by now. But obviously somebody else is in charge. And how do we find out who that is? And then how do we go about eliminating them?
So I guess my concern would be, how does anyone take a race, or if you want to consider us a culture or a group of people, seriously when we come to Trayvon Martin's aid? In this one case, and we allow all these, the 1,000 to happen on a daily basis. How does one take a race or a culture or a group of people seriously when they continue to call themselves the N-word and get outraged if you hear Paula Deen do it? So it's hard for me to understand the two worlds that we live in, especially around trying to get justice in the one case and not in another case for this exact same offense. Help me reconcile that.
Are you talking to me, Mr. Cook?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Well, I think the point you make is valid. It is hard not to treat our kids as thugs and gangsters when too many of our kids self-identify as thugs and gangsters. It is difficult to possess a sense of abuse when someone else calls us the N-word when we repeatedly use the N-word. Now, again, that doesn't justify what George Zimmerman did by any means. It doesn't excuse the patent racism that exists. But I think one of the things that we can do is stop expecting to do for us what we should do for ourselves. And clearly something that we should be about is taking back our culture that has been hijacked by a fool, N-word, dog culture that brings out the absolute worst in us, that puts out the most negative images that you can imagine.
I agree.
So I wonder then, what would be the first step or the first series of step in that direction? I mean, when I hear that, I was speaking to a group of high school students last fall. They were football players at one of the local high schools, and I was out talking to them, and I was kind of giving them kind of a blueprint. And one of the questions that was posed to me after me laying down the blueprint was, okay, I like that. How do I do that? And then I began to kind of lay out a strategy on steps he should take. And so when I hear these things, what would be the first or the first series of steps in the right direction to do that, Leo?
A couple of things. First, stop apologizing for African Americans who hurt and kill other African Americans. I, for one, don't care if they had a bad day. We all have bad days. But there is no excuse for some of the conduct that we engage in against each other. So I think one key is we have got to stop apologizing and apologizing by explanation, because that's what we tend to do as a people. If some African American does something horrendous, we explain it to death, and then after we're through explaining it, it becomes an excuse. I think another thing that we need to do, quite frankly, is devote 80% of our time and attention to young kids, making sure they don't adopt a negative culture in the first place. I think there was some historic great African-American male who said it is easier to fix a child than it is to repair a man. And if you look at this as a health issue, a social health issue, the goal should be prevention instead of cure. Frederick Douglass, I think, is the one who said it is easier to fix a child than it is to repair a man. So we really need to devote our time and attention to making sure that we inculcate the values that we want in young people, as early as 2 and 3 years old. Because by the time they get to be 10 or 15, it becomes extremely difficult to change their mindset. And I think another strategy is that we should be about economics, and we should look at our situation as a question of socioeconomics versus a question of race. Martin Luther King set the standard that we should judge each other by the content of our character and not by the color of our skin.
Excellent point. Jim, what do you think about that? 80% of our time voted towards young people as opposed to the amount of we pour on a large amount of dollars into incarceration and trying to reduce recidivism and trying to do rehabilitation, and we've largely failed. I mean, there are some success stories, and yet we don't make the early investment, not at the same numbers that we do, and when we're trying to do rehabilitation. What do you think about what Leo said, Jima?
Well, I agree with the fact that we should spend more effort in the prevention, because if you prevent it, then you don't have to worry about finding the cure. So he's right about that. I agree with that 100%. I agree, you know, and I recognize that we have not done any anything around prevention. Everything we do is intervention. After something already happens, then we react to it, then we respond. But if we were to invest in that pre-childhood, early childhood education, where we're preparing our kids before they get to school to be ready for school, then we wouldn't have to react and intervene when they're not reading at grade level, because we would make sure they're coming in ready to read at grade level and that we're preparing them on the front end. And you're right, even as it relates to our criminal justice system, it's built on people getting in trouble, and it's not there to rehabilitate. It's there to incarcerate. And so if we can keep them out of there from the beginning, how do you do that? You invest in them on the front end. You provide them with the necessary tools and services that they need to be able to function in this ever-changing world that we find ourselves in. So wholeheartedly, I agree that the front end, if we invest in it on the front end, it's a dollars and cents thing. Because if you do it on the front end, you won't have to worry about it on the back end. We spend more to incarcerate than we do to educate. And that shouldn't be. And so if we focus, as Leo said, on the front end of that and do that investment piece there and treat and diagnose that kid holistically, everything about them that needs to be touched, we need to touch it. And we need to make sure we're impacting him or her in their totality. And then we will begin to see that they'll feel better about themselves, and that thug attitude won't be there, because that's not what they're seeing. They're not seeing thug life, because we have insulated them and provided them with an opportunity to see something past that. Even for the child that grows up in a community that is riddled with drugs and crime, you know, it doesn't mean that they have to go down that path either. So we have to provide them with the services and choices and educate them in such a manner that they'll make a choice at the end of the day to do something different than what they're even seeing being done around them.
Okay. So Leo, then I think what you've said this for years. I mean, we even joked about the fact that we should throw everybody else away and start with that age group. You also mentioned, though, that, you know, Frederick Douglass said that it's easier to fix a child than to repair a man. So and that was, you know, decades, centuries ago. So if this has been a problem that's been known for many, many moons, so why is it then that we can't get that right? What's preventing us from actually doing it, taking that step? Leo, what do you think?
I think one problem is we need to abandon the victim mentality. You and I have had any number of discussions about that. And I understand that African Americans have been victimized. I get that. But that doesn't mean that we should look at ourselves as victims. Because if you see yourself as a victim, there are some psychological burdens that you are, or psychological baggage that you also carry with you, because victims can't help themselves, so therefore they are helpless. Victims are not responsible for what they do because they are victims. It's always somebody else's fault. And if you look at yourself as a victim, if everything is because of racism or the man got me down, or it's my environment, or my cousin, my brother, my uncle, my mama made me do this, then you never take personal responsibility for where you are. No matter what has happened to us, and I will concede that we have suffered immensely for a good 600 or 700 years, but in spite of that, we are still responsible for who we are, and we are still responsible for what we do. So I would really hope that at some point African Americans abandon this sense that we are victims who can't help ourselves and our fate is sealed.
What do you think about that victim mentality, Jima? You think that's something that you see that could potentially prevent us from moving forward?
Well, I agree. I agree that we have to place things in perspective, and at the end of the day, we are responsible for our actions. And working in the field that I do, and I always tell my clients that you made the decision to go out and do whatever you did, regardless of what your mama or daddy didn't do for you, or regardless of what happened to you. They wasn't there when you decided to rob that store, rape that woman, shoot up some people, steal that car. They wasn't there. You made that decision. So you are responsible for your actions. Now, did some of those things play a part in why you made that decision? Probably. But you still made that decision, and you have to deal with the consequences of that decision. So what we can't do is absolve ourselves of our responsibility because of what's happened. We are still responsible for the, for what we do. And oftentimes, we want to blame others, decisions that we're making, and on a small scale, that very well may be true. But that's it. I'm still responsible. I can't continue to blame somebody else for what I am doing or what I am not doing. Because the day I decide that I'm going to be this drug addict and smoke up everything I can find because I'm trying not to deal with whatever pain and abuse I had in my childhood, somewhere along the line, somebody is telling me this is not a good idea, and I'm making a decision not to listen to it. So even in my, you know, even in my, in the most drunken state or highest state, you hear something. And you still have a choice whether you take that first puff or you drink that first shot or not. So we can't completely, I mean, we talk about choice, and God gives us free will. And so at some point we've got to admit where the decisions we've made are as much of a problem for where we are as the years we suffered, as Leo stated. It's not an either or. It's, you know, we have to acknowledge them both, still have some responsibility in the matter of what I decide to do after I acknowledge it.
Yes, that's indeed true. All right, Leo, we're going to wrap up this segment. I want to give you the last word on this and talk a little bit more about Black Acre blog and how people can get in contact with you.
Well, first I want to thank you. I mean, you've been a good friend throughout the years. I really appreciate your support, your championing Black Acre. And I tell you, you read better than I do because I couldn't have read everything that you read without stumbling over 90% of the words. I'm serious. Secondly, Black Acre was never intended to be a vehicle for me. Black Acre has always been a vehicle for everyone else. One of the purposes of Black Acre is to democratize the making of public policy. I don't know about you, but I get tired of hearing the same old voices say the same old things when it comes to public policy. Some of them are good and intelligent, but quite frankly, they're no smarter than you or Jima are. They're no smarter than me. And there are millions of Americans out here who care just as much about America and who are just as adroit at analyzing our public policy issues as the people you see on TV. They simply lack a microphone, a forum, a platform to engage in public policy discussion. And Black Acre is their microphone, their platform, their forum. And so all you have to do is go to www.blackacrepolicyforum.org, and you can post any and everything you want, and you can respond to the blogs, and you can make a difference in your life and in this country of ours. So, again, I just want to thank you. Thanks so much.
All righty. All right, it's about time for to take another break. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook, and when we return, we're going to be talking about that UConn player that was starving. As Jesse Jackson put it years ago, Mars Madness and May Sadness. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
You are listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. My mom and dad will be right back after these messages.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our company's tailor-made training and consulting, current events, and Ask Jima can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy, and I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend, and of course, my Eastbourne friend.
Need a new website? Haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. So I want to shift now to a story that's about a week old, and that's kind of an eternity in the news these days. But I wanted to take a moment and lend my voice to the conversation and to invite our resident expert, Jima, to also, to stimulate thought in this particular topic. And primarily because we've covered it for 4 years, seems to be, that we have talked about some issue that came up in the news with respect to the NCAA tournaments or basketball or football, anything along those lines when it comes to college sports. And so here we are yet again with another controversy, and I want to kind of play a segment, and then I want Jima to respond. Take a listen.
It's hungry nights when I'm not able to eat, but I still got to play up to my capabilities. When you see a jersey getting sold, it may not have a last name on it, but when you see a jersey getting sold, things like that, to some credit, you feel like you want something in return, and sometimes it feels that way. But like I said, I don't think you student athletes should get hundreds of thousands of dollars. There are hungry nights that I go to bed and I'm starving. What's definitely best to get a scholarship to our universities, but at the end of the day, that doesn't cover everything.
So Jima, this was in response to a question that was asked about the students being having the right to unionize. We talked about that last week, and then quite naturally, right after that, he was asked his question and he wanted to lay his opinion. So first, let me offer that I kind of applaud him. They talk about academics being able to have academic freedom, which means that you can essentially voice your opinion without retribution. And so I think the same should be offered up to students, or for the most part, the American people, to be able to offer their opinion or lend their opinion or lend their voice to an issue without retribution. And I haven't heard anything yet, as of yet, that has been against the young man. He actually went on to win a championship and being a major contributor to the win. But I wonder, though, A, will there be some retribution in the future? And B, what do you think about this coming up for this particular student, and how do you think it's impacting other students in college sports?
Well, the beauty and the downside of a live interview after a big win. Remember what happened to Richard Sherman from Seattle after they won, and the comment and how he responded, and all of a sudden he was being a thug because of what he had to say, which was his truth. So in this case, the young man, is asked a question about an issue that we've been talking about in college athletics for a while now. Probably long before he got to college, because I think he's probably like maybe a sophomore or so. So this conversation goes back longer to even his time he's been in school. So he's asked a question. I think they were on their way to the Final Four. And they were on their way to the championship game. And so he makes this statement about life of a college athlete. Now, I wish I could say that what he had to say was untrue, but it's not. And the pushback has been, what I've heard on talk radio this week, there has been some that wanted to try to say, that's not true, and athletes, they don't ever go to bed hungry, and he's just being dramatic. And that's not true. I mean, and in response to that, I was listening to Joe Madison's show, you had several former athletes call in and talk about life on the college campus. And so, I'm glad he was strong enough to answer that question honestly and truthfully and unfiltered. And you felt for him that, the amount of times when he stated, he's gone to bed hungry. I mean, who in college hasn't gone to bed hungry a time or two? But, I'm not giving an entity 60 hours of my life a week either. And that's what they do during season time, is between 40 and 60 hours. It's a full-time job. And yet, the benefit is the education. However, the colleges is making all the money, as are the coaches. So, he even was clear. I don't think they should get hundreds of thousands of dollars, because that was somebody's idea this week, that that's how much they should get paid. So he even made, I'm not saying that, but they need something. You selling my jersey with my name on the back, and folks walking around with my jersey, and I don't get none of that. So at some point, the NCAA has gotten away with having it both ways, and I think, we're at a point now where people are really focusing and can really see the injustice of it all. And I think those voices might finally, finally outweigh the naysayers, hopefully.
Yeah, I think it's going to take an act of Congress, literally, in order to do anything. And, saying it's going to take an act of Congress does not really say much, because they don't really get anything done. So it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds over the years to come, because it's certainly time, right? It really takes a collective movement, and what I mean by collective, I'm talking about the students, the parents, the fans, the coaches, the teams, the administration. It really takes all of them to begin to take a step back, to reevaluate the situation, because the policy that were in place, a century ago, it may need to be relooked at, revisited. And so I think that's what people are asking for. Now, quite naturally, when it comes to money, and when it comes to, I'm going to say transfer of wealth, but when it comes to paying these kids their worth, that has a lot of implications of pulling people out of poverty, you know. And so I think it's an overall good thing, especially if you don't have people going behind backs, and, you know, and it has to be done in the right way. You know, it should be done with some education. It should be done with some, you know, some maybe some annuity has to be a part of it, as opposed to giving somebody all cash up front. You know, especially when you give a person a lot of money that is not used to having a lot of money, they always, you know, don't make the best. They don't always make the best choices. So, I mean, I think there's a lot to be looked into before, but I think. You know, I think it's worth looking into. So, you know, we're definitely coming on the last part of the show. Before we do that, I want you to talk a little bit about Scandal. What do you think is going on with Scandal?
Man, Scandal is completely out of control. I'm not sure how it's going to end. I'm actually looking forward to it. This past week's episode was just unreal with Mama Pope showing up at Olivia's and them office, and then next thing we know, Daddy Pope laid out on the floor stabbed, and I'm like, well, how did this happen? Because they didn't show us that part, and then, you know, Huck and Quinn out in the garage getting their groove on, and then Columbus, Harrison is somewhere, I'm about to call him by his real name, he's somewhere tied up with the woman, and she got a gun pointed at him. I mean, it's just, it's too much. And then Melly finna spill the beans on the baby, oh, my goodness, I don't know. I don't know how. I don't even know if he can get reelected after all this. I don't know.
Yeah, I have to agree. It's certainly going to be a season finale, one that we'll talk about, I'm pretty sure, all over the entire summer. Okay, any final thoughts? We're coming up on the end of the show. Any final thoughts?
Well, I have three final thoughts. There's two other shows that I'm watching that I think our listening audience, if you haven't had the opportunity to view them, one is Resurrection, starring Omar Epps, and it talks about people that have died and they're coming back. And it's kind of weird how they're coming back, and now one that came back just all of a sudden disappeared. And so it's an interesting twist of you know, of, in my opinion, of faith in what you believe, and thus the title Resurrection. And then there's Crisis that comes on Sunday evenings as well, and it has Lance Gross in it as a CIA agent who was on detail when a bus full of children of high-powered parents, as well as the president's son, the bus gets kidnapped, and the kids get kidnapped. And so he survived, and now they're trying to find out who's in charge of the kidnapping, what do they want, and they've been using the parents to pull off different things, stopping drones because of their high, when I say high level, high power, they're at the top of the food chain. And so it's been quite interesting to watch that unfold on Sunday evenings. And if you haven't caught those two shows, I highly recommend them. My other closing thought, of course, is I thank all of those who listened in last week or listened in over the course of the week to the interview, those out there who have gone to our website, TaylorMade101.com, /reflection, and purchased my book. I appreciate it. You can continue to purchase your book and on the website, Reflection, like my page on Facebook, Reflection, What I Know to Be True. I will be having my first book signing next Friday, April 25th, in Kansas City, Kansas, at the Country Inn and Suites Hotel. I am in town for a conference entitled Women Breaking the Chains of Bondage. And so I will be there on Friday evening at 8 o'clock Friday, April 25th, at the Country Inn and Suites in Kansas City, Kansas, at Village West. And then on that Saturday, April 26th, I'll be at the conference between the hours of probably 10 and 2 doing my book signing. And I'm there at the conference all day, and that's going to be at Mount Olivet Institutional Baptist Church in Kansas City, Kansas, on 7th Street. So I'll be there all day on that Saturday. So two book signings. I went back home to kick it all off with my book signings, and then when I get back here, I'll have a couple more here in the city, here in Dallas and Plano and Garland and all over here in Texas, trying to empower, and that is what I hope you get out of my book. So thank you for your support.
All right, that's our show for today. I would like to thank all our listeners for tuning in, and a special thanks to my co-host, Jima Hill Cook. You can follow her on Twitter, and that's at AskJima. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. Now, don't forget to bookmark this site and visit my blog at TaylorMadeTalkRadio.blogspot.com. That's TaylorMade TalkRadio.blogspot.com. Until next time, remember, it is written, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. So stay engaged, stay informed, and stay plugged in to Current Events with Patrick Cook. All righty.